welcome to the CCFR Radio Podcast, your source for news, updates, and stories from the CCFR.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 7 of the CCFR Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Rod Geltacka. Thanks for listening in. In this episode 7, we'll have a little bit of firearm news to talk about. I'm also going to take a couple of questions that I found interesting, and those questions come from our closed Facebook group. If you're not in that group, try to get in. It's a fairly large group. I think we're around 18,000 people in there. So I will also have a special shout out to make to a very special person. And I'll finish up with an interesting interview with Scott Carpenter from International Shooting Supplies. And it's actually about his 3-week trip to Africa. And when Scott told me about this trip, he had some really interesting information. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, but about how these game preserves and these hunting outfitters, how they operate, how they pay for their operations, and what they do on the conservation front, and even from an ecological perspective and a carbon footprint perspective, it was quite interesting. So anyway, stay tuned for that. So let's get the show on the road. We will be back right after this.
The UN marking regulations coming into force in December 2018 will do absolutely nothing to improve public safety or reduce criminal use of firearms. Everyone in the government knows this, yet they're still going forward with it. This regulation will, however, raise the average price of a firearm $100 to $300 and create a de facto long gun registry. Let Canada's politicians and bureaucrats know they do not have your consent. Stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms. Donate now or become a member at www.firearmrights.ca.
And now, the news on CCFR Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. A couple of news items in the last week. But before I get to that, I'll just tell you guys, full disclosure, I lost my voice. It's been almost 2 weeks ago, and I lost my voice for 10 days. Unfortunately, I had lost my voice on a Friday, and I had to teach a firearm safety course over the weekend, so I had to talk for 16 hours over 2 days, and I blew my voice out so bad that I just got it back literally a couple of days ago, and you're going to hear it. It's still pretty shaky. So please just put up with that. I should be at 100% next podcast, but that's why you're going to hear my voice giving out from time to time. Anyway, a couple of news items in the last week I wanted to touch on. First, an item that directly concerns the CCFR, and that is we've activated the domain ccfr.ca. So when we first started the CCFR, that was not available. Somebody owned it, so we went with firearmrights.ca. And in fact, firearmrights.ca, the domain, predates me. I wasn't even involved yet. So that's what we had available to us. Now, our good friend, Treasurer and General Counsel Mike Loberg, unbeknownst to me, I had no idea that he did this, but a while back, he had contacted the person that owns ccfr.ca and bought the domain from him and gifted it to the CCFR. And now, Mike, if Mike's listening to this, he's probably getting mad because he probably doesn't want people to know that he does that kind of stuff. But that's the kind of guy that Mike is, and he's just awesome. And Mike does that kind of stuff all the time. Nobody knows about those things, but I think some people should. So thank you very much, Mike, for doing that. And it's Mike's help is the CCFR wouldn't be what it is today without Mike's influence and his. How much he's helped us. And like I say, nobody knows how much that actually is. And I don't think he wants anybody to know, but thanks again to Mike for that. Now, so you're going to see that domain out there. It will, if you go to ccfr.ca, it'll take you to the website, but I don't know if we're going to, we've made such an investment in the firearmrights.ca domain. All our emails are like that. People have them. Firearmrights.ca is all over everything. So maybe you'll see a slow kind of transition to that because it's a, for people like me that can't use home keys when they type, it saves me a little bit of time trying to get to the website. So anyway, that's hanging around out there. Next up is a draft of the Quebec Long Gun Registry had been released. And of course, it's a nightmare, right? So I'm not going to talk about the details of the actual draft of how that program is going to work, because you can go to firearmrights.ca and read the story, follow some links. I think there's also going to be an opinion piece going to get put up there that's sort of like a case study with some links and some, you know, archived information and stuff. So you can keep an eye on the website for that. But, you know, I just want to make a couple of comments and answer a couple of questions. So, you know, this is a vanity project. Okay, that's all this has ever been, is a vanity project that's being launched in a province that spends billions and billions of borrowed dollars on ideological and completely pointless projects. This is what they do. And unfortunately, I think for gun owners, that Quebec resides in a country that spends billions and billions of borrowed dollars on ideological and completely ineffective and pointless projects. So it's a real uphill battle. I mean, you know, it's not even just gun control, right? This is a phenomenon that is raging right now in our country. And if you're at all, in tune with what's going on, you know, it looks like it's only accelerating. So, you know, you have StatsCan, an actual government agency, a government organization that provides you with statistical factual data that completely destroys the support for these ridiculous projects. So, you know, and this has been done at a federal level and was a complete disaster, just wildly over budget, billions of dollars wasted, and not a single crime prevented. So I don't spend a lot of time on social media. I have kind of popped on to Facebook a few times this week and looked around. I see people doing what people normally do, which is, what's the CCFR going to do about our problem in Quebec? And, you know, it's somewhat a valid question. We are a gun group, but I've got a couple of comments about that. And I guess you're kind of hearing it from the horse's mouth. So the CCFR itself is a public relations organization, and we operate federally. That's what we do, because firearms are a federal jurisdiction. Now, most recently, we have developed some capabilities in lobbying at a federal level. So that's the mandate of the CCFR, and our mandate really hasn't been lobbying in the past. We just did that I'm not going to say asked to do it, but we were pushed in that direction because of just the reaction, the relationship we were building with government, with the federal government. And we had to register a lobbyist because it was, more than anything, compliance, because we are consulting and having conversations about legislation and that kind of stuff and regulation. And if you're going to do that kind of stuff, you're supposed to be registered. So it was kind of an evolution how we ended up there. We do not have any provincial lobbying capabilities, and we don't have really any provincial public relations capabilities. If we did that, we don't have the resources to do that, because we're doing everything we can on a federal level, which helps Quebec gun owners, because federally, the federal government can have a lot more of an effect on what Quebecers can do with their guns. And we're busy trying to keep the federal government off their backs. When it comes to provincial advocacy, Quebec has a group called the TCRQ, and they are a fairly new group, and they're 100% Quebec. And it's, and I'll tell you this, because I'm, you know, at some point, like, I don't always hold back, right? Sometimes I pull no punches. I'm not going to pull any punches right here, so you're going to hear it right from me. We reached out to the TCRQ, and we offered them money out of our budget, not this past AGM, but the AGM before. And they didn't want to accept anything from us. We still continue to try to build a relationship with them, because Quebec is the epicenter of gun control in Canada. And we wanted to be involved, and we wanted to help. And Tracy Wilson went to three of their events, their protests/rallies. And we still couldn't get any kind of relationship going with them. We were pretty rejected. This is really not any different than we've done with other gun groups. For some reason, gun groups in Canada, they just don't want to work together, or they work together with one other group, which is very rare, but it's happening right now with the TCRQ, and they just reject everybody else. So it's I don't know where the division comes from, or how that all started, or why it continues to perpetuate itself. It's pretty disappointing. But you know, typically I don't talk about this kind of stuff because I'm not really a finger pointer, but you know, people ask, and I'm going to tell you, right? So we've put quite a bit of effort trying to build relationships in Quebec, and have just been rejected. And so we're just going to focus our efforts federally, And again, that's going to help Quebec gun owners regardless, because, you know, changes are coming federally, and it's going to take a really strong organization, the organization that the CCFR has become, to hopefully just hold that back until the next election cycle, because we're certainly not going to get any favors from the current government. They're not big fans of gun owners. So anyway, one last thing that I will mention about this topic in particular is that when it comes to Quebecers and what they can do, think about this for a second. This measure, when it was a draft resolution, when it was a draft law, and it was put out for a vote, it passed by, it was unanimous. 100% of, I don't know what they call them in Quebec, but in British Columbia, they're MLAs, right? And 100% of them voted for this, you know? And of course, this is ridiculous. Quebec is $184 billion in debt as a province. $184 billion. And it's not even just Quebec, but it's most provincial governments. And of course, our federal government is just the most irresponsible government I've ever seen. It's just incredible. Like, it's so detached from reality, so out of touch with reality. It's just breathtaking. It's hard to even get my head around how bad it really is. But anyway, this measure passed with 100% of the vote. So for Quebecers, I think Quebecers really need to stand up and help Quebecers. Quebecers need to call their, equivalents to our MLAs and say, what the hell is going on over there? Like, what are you guys doing? This was a federal failure. It cost $2 billion when it was supposed to cost a few million dollars, and it never stopped a crime ever. So anyway, that's the situation with the CCFR, I think, and the Quebec Long Gun Registry. So, you know, I wish Quebecers the best of luck. You have to get active. The TCRQ is out there. They're all French. They're all about Quebec. I think that's a great group. You can go there, join their rallies, talk to your MLA equivalent, continue to support the CCFR at a federal level, because at least we can try to hold back the feds from piling on as well. So I don't know if that's the answer that some people wanted, but that's the answer that I have for you for now. Next up, we've got this story from Castlegar, British Columbia. You guys might have seen this in the media and mainstream media. As the story goes, and details are always sketchy when it comes to these types of stories. And I don't know whether it's because we're, as gun owners, always really interested in the details, or and that all stories are like that, or details were kind of sketchy in this one. But my understanding of the story is, and you can find it out there, it's still floating around on Facebook and stuff, is that there's a guy up there, lives in a restaurant that he operates. Somebody's breaking in. He goes downstairs with his .22 revolver, of all things, and ends up getting bear sprayed in the face, lets a couple rounds go, hits the assailant, and the criminal takes off. This guy is saved, although severely bear sprayed, and the police let him go. The Crown chooses not to charge him with a criminal offense. So, highly encouraging story. I think it's just phenomenal. I think that the overwhelming majority of situations like that should have that outcome, where the victim remains the victim and is held harmless. Just my personal opinion, no matter how much harm comes to the criminal. I know I'm not going to be popular among criminals now for saying that, but I don't care if criminals get hurt in the commission of crimes. I don't care how badly they get hurt. And again, that's just my opinion. I mean, you make a conscious choice to break into somebody's, someone's business that is their only way to feed themselves and to support themselves, and thus not be on the system, no less. And then you try to assault them and spray them in the face with bear spray and turn them into a physical victim, and then you get what's coming to you. I'm actually pretty okay with that. In fact, as it relates to the CCFR, if you look at our policies, we are very strong proponents. And personally, I am a vehement proponent of firearms for self-defense, because that is absolutely morally and practically appropriate. I have a real issue with anyone that seems to think that they should determine how and if and when I can defend myself if somebody's trying to, assault, rape, or murder me, right? And I think people of smaller stature or more vulnerable people in our communities have so much to gain by having a relationship with firearms and by legally being able to use a firearm to defend themselves. So a couple of quick notes right here. I typically get asked a lot of times in training, like, you know, can you use a firearm to defend yourself like you can in the States? Can you do that in Canada? And of course, the answer, and I'm not a lawyer, there's my disclaimer, right? This is not legal advice. But it might be a good way to know where to look for the proper legal advice. And you should always consult a lawyer. You know what? I guess I could say you can always buy that legal advice package from the CCFR. What is it? $16 a year or something? I'm probably got that wrong because I don't look at that stuff, right? But you can call a lawyer as many times as you want over the course of a year for $16. So pretty awesome. So that's always, don't listen to me. Just go do that. That's better. And so that's my disclaimer. But nonetheless, I tell people, yes, you can use a firearm to defend yourself in Canada. You always could, right? From since forever. It's just very complex. And even if you meet the requirements that your use of force was proportional to the threat, and your use of force was reasonable in the circumstances, and you took in all of the variables and you were able to make a decision that quickly, they still may charge you with a criminal offense. Because the process is the punishment in Canada. They'll just destroy your life through bleeding you dry financially and destroying your reputation. In this case, that didn't happen. Now, here's something to think about. I'm wondering personally if it didn't happen because of the changes that were part of Bill C-24 a number of years back. The Conservatives passed that bill. It was called the Citizen Self-Defense and Citizen Arrest Act. And one of the primary changes, there was a few changes in there. If you guys hadn't heard about it, you should maybe look it up if it's still kicking around, because it's quite interesting. Back in the before Bill C-24, and the reason why a lot of people got charged with a criminal offense, even though they did everything right, aside from having a system with incredible malintent to law-abiding citizens, and that's not an opinion, it's very well documented. besides that, the criminal code used to say the preamble to all of these conditions, whether your actions were reasonable, where an individual may not be charged with guilty of an offense if. So when the law says an individual may not be guilty of an offense if they met all of this criteria, that means a lot of times the Crown will just say, well, let the judge decide. I'm not the judge. So, you know, they'll decide whether you're guilty. Well, the minute that they say that, you're in for, you know, $40,000, $60,000, right? And thus the process is the punishment. Whereas one of the main changes, other than considering the physical ability of your assailants, considering just there was a lot of extra little changes in Bill C-24, but the biggest one was that part of it was changed from an individual may not be guilty of an offense to an individual may not be charged with an offense if. So that was a big thing. So now you can't be charged with an offense if you met all this criteria. The problem was that even though that law was passed a long time ago, we haven't had a lot of case law. So I'm wondering, and I haven't looked into it myself, whether this is an example of case law that considered that an individual may not be charged with an offense if. So anyway, I always recommend to anybody, if it's rattling around the back of your head that you're going to use a firearm for a purpose of self-defense, I would read the criminal code, the sections on self-defense, read that like 30 times and understand it very clearly and understand the criteria. There's also documentation that you can secure that the Crown Council uses, depending on how individual provinces operate. But there are publications on how the Crown determines whether you met those legal tests to be charged with an offense. And I would also look for case laws as much as you can on self-defense involving firearms, because this is all stuff that you would need. It's just good stuff to know, because God forbid you're ever in that situation, whether you meant to be in that situation or not. You can't wrestle with all of these things, you know, if you're in danger of losing your life from some kind of criminal act, right? That's not the time to be weighing all this stuff or looking stuff up. It's just not reality. So anyway, I thought that was a really interesting story there. So what I want to do is I'm going to wrap up this part of the news section, because there's a lot of other stuff news stories that we could dissect and kind of chat about real quick. But this has gone on long enough, and I've got some questions from some CCFR group members. And I also have a really, really interesting interview coming up with Scott Carpenter from International Shooting Supplies, who actually went out to Africa. So I'm excited to play that one for you. It's quite an interesting story on a lot of levels. All right, so we will get back to the questions right after this.
Over the past 25 years, tens of thousands of Canadians have had their firearms taken by no fault of their own through arbitrary reclassifications, paperwork errors, or senseless prohibitions. The government's perfect vision of Canada does not include you or your firearms. Let Canada's politicians and bureaucrats know they do not have your consent. Stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms by joining the CCFR right now at www.firearmrights.ca.
All right, everybody, we're back. Thanks for sticking with me. I'm going to answer a couple of questions that we got here in our closed Facebook group. If you're not a member of that Facebook group, try to get in. I think there's almost 18,000 people on there, and it's a very well administrated group, so it's a pretty easygoing place to be. We try to keep the disputes and the bad language and stuff to a minimum, so that it's the best for the widest audience possible. Nonetheless, before I start the questions, I just want to do one thing. Every podcast, I'm going to make a point of doing a shout out or shouts out. Is that the plural for shout out? Anyway, is there such a thing? But I want to recognize a couple of people for doing something out of the ordinary or something great to help the community and stuff. And I have a very specific shout out right now, and that's for a gentleman named Barry Tulk. So Barry won the last contest that we ran. For the life of me, I can't remember what it was called. Probably the ultimate something or other. We've run a few contests, and my brain is like a baked potato from doing a lot of these things. So, and then trying to make a living on as well at the same time. But I just want to tell you this: Barry won $10,000. Basically, for all intents and purposes, it's a $10,000 store credit for International Shooting Supplies, right? For anything he wants in the store. So pretty awesome. Barry bought the stuff that he wanted, and he spent about 2/3 of that $10,000, and he said, you know what, I've got everything I need. I just want to donate the rest right back to the CCFR. And I'll tell you, I did not expect that. And I'll tell you this, I'll be totally honest, I sure wouldn't have done it, because when it comes to ammunition, I'm kind of a hoarder. So I would have been hoarding ammunition like crazy. And I just what a tremendous thing. So thank you, Barry. And you totally deserve the recognition for it. If you see Barry, kicking around on Facebook, give him a big thank you for his support of the CCFR. I couldn't think of a better person to win the contest. Sorry, my voice is still dying, than Barry for that. So thanks again. And you definitely deserve the recognition, Barry. All right, time for a question. Now, I was going to answer a couple of questions from folks on our closed Facebook group there, but the answers, to give a thorough answer, takes so long. So I'm only going to answer one question, because this podcast is getting long, and I still got a really good interview with Scott that I want you guys to hear, because it's super interesting coming up. So only one question. I will answer a couple of these next time around. This one comes from Jason Harrington. What is the legal requirement for transporting ammunition to and from a range, or anywhere else for that matter, as per section 86 subsection 1 of the criminal code? Example, can I simply throw half a case of 9mm in the back of the SUV, no trunk? And head to the range. Pistols are stored trigger locked in a locked container. Must the ammunition be locked up? And if so, then why is that different from going to the gun shop and buying that same case of 9mm and transporting it home? Ammunition storage and transport is always an ongoing debate at our club. So a couple of things. Real quick, you are not legally obligated to lock ammunition. That really doesn't appear anywhere. There are no storage requirements for ammunition. The law tells you sort of what you can do. The law typically tells you what you can't do. You know, it tells you it's written from a negative perspective, because if the law were to, you know, to always tell you what you can do, that would be a pretty thick book. So they're pretty much telling you what's illegal. Sometimes a law will phrase what's illegal by saying, here's some examples of approved ways of doing things. And ammunition is very, very seldom referenced. So with storage, it is referenced, and this actually causes a lot of confusion. So let me give you an example, and then I'll kind of relate that to transportation. So in the storage regulation, it says, I'll give you one example. I'll give you two. A firearm may be legally stored by, let's say, for non-restricted. The firearm has to be unloaded in a securely locked container. So let's say a gun case. Ammunition may be stored in that container. The container itself has to be locked in, has to be difficult to break into. So they're saying, yeah, ammunition can be stored together with the firearm in a locked container. So this is one of the few examples of when they tell you what you can do. Typically, they tell you what you can't. Another example is in a gun safe. Firearm has to be unloaded, securely locked in the securely locked safe, vault, or room specifically designed or adapted for the secure storage of firearms. I'm rattling this off because I memorized a stupid book, right? Because I've had to read it so many times. And ammunition in the safe is basically okay. Whereas, and this is what caused a lot of confusion, in transportation, the regulation doesn't specifically reference ammunition. So it doesn't say, for instance, that if I'm transporting my restricted firearm to and from a place I'm allowed to, you know, transport it, it doesn't specifically say that ammunition may not be in the container with the firearm. It just talks about the firearm. The firearm has to be unloaded, secure locking device on the firearm in a locked container. And I think for transport, it just says a container that cannot be opened up accidentally during transport or something like that, right? And so what that says is ammunition is absent. So it doesn't say that I can't do something. So if the law specifically doesn't tell me that I can't do something, that means that it's not illegal to do it. So again, not legal advice, but this is how, as far as I'm aware, all instructors that are certified by the Canadian Firearms Program have been teaching it, because that's the way it's written in the book. So can you keep ammunition in there with the gun? Yeah. Can you keep ammunition anywhere in the vehicle? Yes. But if you look on page 59 of the Canadian Firearms Safety Course manual, it's one book now instead of two, but on page 59, the firearms program is specifically asking you to keep firearms and ammunition out of sight during transport. It says transport and storage, but out of sight during transport. And that's so you don't have unneeded, unnecessary interactions with law enforcement. You don't scare the public or waste police resources because somebody sees ammunition or a fire, or what they think is a firearm in your car, and call the police. So, you know, just keep it, my advice to you, just not legal advice, but personal advice as a firearm owner, keep it out of sight, and you can keep it in the same container, in my opinion, as the firearm if you want, as long as it's securely locked and the firearm is being transported legally, or just keep it outside the container, you know, out of sight. So anyway, hopefully that answers that question. When it comes to people's impression about the law, I'm always amazed, because I get all kinds of questions. You know, I had on multiple occasions had people coming to the firearm safety course and saying, well, you know, apparently with restricted firearms, you got to call the RCMP every time you transport your handgun to the range. I said, well, there's more restricted firearms other than handguns, and B, that's not true. you don't have to do that. I don't know where that stuff comes from, but it's out there. And you know what? Law enforcement is not exempt from this issue either. And I always tell my students, don't ever rely on law enforcement to know the law, because they don't know it. Your typical general duty member is a generalist, right? They have to know traffic laws and firearm laws and criminal code violations and the Liquor Control Act. They have to know a little bit about a lot of things, right? So they don't always know that stuff. I'm certainly not defending them. If they did have detailed knowledge about the Firearms Act and the regulations and common practices, then that would be a great thing. That would mean they were extra good at their job, but they typically won't know it. And on occasion, a lot of this knowledge gets transferred verbally, right? So they may have a watch commander that says, oh yeah, the ammunition has to be separate from the firearm. Well, no, there's no law that ever said that. And it gets passed around as truth. I had an interesting experience with a fairly competent RCMP member regarding body armor in British Columbia. And he told me that they were instructed, the watch commander told him they were instructed to arrest anyone that didn't have a body armor permit that was in possession of body armor. And I'm like, well, you don't need a permit. If you have a PAL, you are exempt from the body armor regulation. You don't need a permit. And he's like, well, is that true? And I went to work and came back and goes, holy man, you're right. You know, all that information we had was wrong. I'm like, well, I'm glad we had this chat. I don't know why it was up to me to tell you that. But anyway, so that's what you're facing out there. So always know the regulation really well yourself and be confident in it. I don't think there's anything wrong with even printing those regulations out or photocopying the Canadian Firearms Safety Course manual. You can get the PDFs to the manual online and just print out a couple of the pages that show the regulation. And that way, if there's a dispute on the roadside, you can always just say, hey, look, show me where ammunition is mentioned in any of this stuff as it applies to transporting firearms. You know? So anyway, hopefully that helps. Like I said, you can just stay out of trouble by keeping that out of sight and also using a really sturdy container instead of, you know, something that you could break into with your hands, right? When you're transporting, there's a lot of ways that you can kind of, you know, stay really close to the line to the minimum legal requirement. I just don't recommend you do that because it's just not worth the hassle. Anyway, as I said, hopefully that helps. And we will answer some more questions next time. So stay tuned after this break, and we will have that very interesting interview with Scott Carpenter from International Shooting Supplies.
Hunters and sports shooters have a lot more in common than they think. Politicians and bureaucrats will never stop pushing toward their vision of Canada where only the police and the military have firearms. All gun owners need to stand together. An attack on one is an attack on us all. Let these people know they do not have your consent. Stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms. Donate now or become a member of the CCFR at www.firearmrights.ca. And now, a CCFR exclusive interview.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. We're going to have an interview with Scott Carpenter of International Shooting Supplies. And what I wanted to talk to Scott about today... Hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Rod?
Good. I've got to be polite. What I wanted to talk to Scott about today was a conversation that we had, and I wanted to share this with all you guys, is a conversation we had about Scott's trip to Africa. He went to go shoot a bunch of animals or whatever at some big ranch kind of thing.
Yeah, and it was an outfitter in Namibia, actually, is where it was. Yeah.
Right. And what was really interesting to me and what I wanted to share was he talked about the financial model or the conservation model. And I think it's an interesting conversation to have for anyone that has maybe some ideas against hunting or think that hunting is wasteful or is cruel or whatever. But yeah, anyway, I wanted to share that with everybody. So tell us about your trip and kind of make your way over to our conversation that we had last time, Scott.
Okay, well, we went to Namibia, and this was in August, and we spent, between travel time and the time we spent hunting and touring around, probably the better part of the month there. Now, to understand why the countries in Africa have the type of conservation model that they do, you have to understand that a country like Namibia, even though it's pretty big geographically, if you look at it on the map, I'm going to guess it's somewhere in the size of Texas, but it's only got a population of about 2 million people. So the one thing that a country like Namibia lacks that we don't is a tax base. So when they're dealing with issues like conservation, they have to come up with a solution that works for them in a way that's financially viable. So because there's not a ton of tax money to draw from, their conservation model is completely different than ours. In some ways, it's a lot more successful too. So the outfitter that we decide we want to hunt with, and this is something that my son and I decided we wanted to do about a year ago, manages wildlife on a piece of property that's roughly 300,000 acres. So that 300,000 acres is actually split up into a variety of different sections. The core of the property, which is in the 80 to 100,000 acre range, is actually owned by the outfitter, and it's actually a preserve. And that preserve is a rhino conservation project. So their primary mission is actually to grow and expand the preserve in order to protect and expand the rhino population in the region. So on that 80 to 100,000 acres, these folks are right now managing about 60 white and black rhinos. And the way that they fund this is through selling hunts for plains game species. So plains game, that's a pretty common term in the hunting world and in the safari world. We use it to describe animals like antelope and giraffe and warthogs and all the smaller animals that populate the country in a much more numerous manner than other species like, say, elephant or lion. And then outside of the main preserve, the outfit is managing external properties like cattle ranches and native land and stuff like that. And they're doing it on behalf of the people who own those pieces of property. So all in all, in total, you're looking at about 300,000 acres that an outfit like we hunted with will manage for wildlife. The big difference you notice right away between their model and our model is game density. The game density is like nothing that North Americans, particularly Canadians especially, are used to seeing. There's game everywhere. So, you know, it's a big change and a big shock to the system if you're a hunter. So the challenge in going to a place like Namibia isn't in finding game, because you'll find it around every corner, literally. The challenge is in always finding and working in their management model, mature males of the species. So when we're hunting deer in the high country here, for example, you know, in October we'll have an any buck season, and that gives us the opportunity to shoot a 1 or 2 year old deer or a 5 to 8 year old deer. That decision's up to the hunter. Whereas in Namibia, they don't generally shoot the younger animals. They don't shoot the females. They're looking for older males to cull out of the herd. So they're controlling their population a little bit differently. It's a different management model altogether.
So very finely managed.
Very finely managed, very finely tuned all the time. Mm-hmm. They run a fine line always between having too much game on the properties and at times not having enough, because one of the things they're dealing with, of course, in a place like Namibia is drought. And you know, it's a desert country already by and large. So, you know, with the exception of the Caprivi Strip, which is up in the northeast corner of the country, most of the country is desert. And so one of the things that they do in a really bad drought year is they feed their game. So all that money that we spend as hunters is put right back into the ranch. So they do a lot of different things with it. So what they'll buy property, they buy feed, you know, they'll use that money to buy equipment. Just for example, you know, one of the animals that we noticed was really overpopulated, or on the verge of being overpopulated, it seemed all the time, by North American standards, was giraffes. Giraffes are everywhere. And we called it, we actually at one time, we didn't call it this, but one of the professional hunters who acts as your guide called the place Jurassic Park. And it was a pretty apt description. And it got that way primarily because their main hunting clientele is North Americans, Canadians, and primarily Americans. And we just don't see giraffe as a game species, so very few of us ever shoot them. So they've invested money in equipment like helicopters and mobile corrals and all sorts of things, so that in order to keep the giraffe population under control and to keep it from eating itself out of house and home, they'll live trap these animals. And this is one of the things that unfortunately we didn't get to see them do while we were there, that I would have loved to have been a part of, was actually setting up these mobile corrals and watching them use the helicopter to corral herds of giraffe or springbuck or any of these really super numerous antelope species that they have there. Mm-hmm. And then truck them up and take them off to another park or another ranch to populate another area of the country.
So one of the things that you said to me when you first got back, you said, you know, I said, well, you know, did you eat any exotic animals? And you said, yeah, I ate giraffe.
Yeah.
Giraffe lasagna.
Giraffe lasagna was the first thing we ate when we walked through the door. So, you know, they keep all this wildlife under control through a variety of ways. And really the hunting barely puts a dent in the animal population for them. You know, they cater to approximately 40 hunters a year, from what I could understand. They take on average through hunting about 300 head of game off of the property. And this is out of a population that in terms of game animals, and we're talking about across the whole plains game spectrum here of tens of thousands of animals. Mm-hmm. So 300 animals out of that type of population really doesn't make that big a difference. So they have to live trap, they have to sell to other places, they have to move these animals out, or they'll literally just eat themselves out of house and home. They also cull, and culling is something that they do when they have a need for it. Mm-hmm. You know, they use the meat for a variety of reasons. You know, an operation that big, I asked them while we were there how many people they had working for them, and I think the number was upwards of about 80. And they actually have it's like a community. It's unless you see it, it's really difficult to understand it. But because the ranch is so isolated from any major population center, everybody lives there. Everybody lives and works right on the ranch. It's like a community itself.
Mm. And eats there.
And eats yeah. there. And so they have a school on the property. They have everything there. They have a small store. They've got lots there. And this is outside of the main hunting camp, of course. This is back at the main lodge where the ecotourists are. But, you know, they've got to feed all these people. So that meat always goes back to feed the people that are actually involved in the operations of the outfit.
When you do shoot something, that's what happens to the meat.
Yeah, by law, we're not allowed to bring the meat back. So the only thing we're allowed to take out of the country are the trophies, which is the hides and the heads and the skulls. And that's once they're treated. It's easier for us to actually have the taxidermy done there and have it all shipped back that way. But the meat itself stays. You know, when my son shot a small animal called a steenbuck one day, our tracker and skinner actually just took the whole animal home with them, you know. But all that meat goes back to feeding the people who live there. Mm-hmm. And whatever's excess, they can sell. So if there's excess, then they can sell to restaurants in the city and stuff like that as well. So the ranch is completely self-sustaining in that sense.
So nothing goes to waste.
Never.
You know, animals aren't, you know.
In fact, I'd say they use
laying
more.
They're rotting, right?
No. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would say they actually probably use more of the animal than we as North Americans do. There's stuff that they see a purpose for that we don't. Mm-hmm. You know, like they use dogs for tracking as an example, and those dogs have to be fed. So they keep the stomach lining from most of the different antelope species, and they'll actually use it. They'll clean it in the processing area and turn it into dog food. So, I mean, literally nothing goes to waste. And I mean, I don't know anyone who's ever kept the stomach lining from a deer or a moose. That's just unheard of.
Yeah.
You know.
So they're trying to preserve rhinos primarily.
Correct.
And it's incredibly expensive.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a pretty honorable pursuit to try to, you know.
Yeah, rhino poaching is a huge problem in Africa. You know, there's a significant part of the population in the world that thinks that the horn of the rhino, once it's crushed up and ground into powder, has some sort of medicinal value to it, but it doesn't. But that doesn't stop people from poaching these things. And so there's a huge amount of money invested in keeping these animals alive, you know, just in fencing and security alone, the expense has to be astronomical, right? So when you're there, all the main roads, the country roads, you know, if we were up in the interior of the province booting around a country road, you'd never see a checkpoint or anything like that. But there's checkpoints at the main intersections on the primary country roads. We're not talking about the bush roads here, we're talking about rural roads, right? Mm-hmm. So range roads. And those checkpoints are there to keep poachers out and to keep that sort of thing under control because, you know, the rhino poaching is a huge problem in Africa. I think in South Africa last year, they were telling me they had over 1,400 rhinos poached. Mm. And most of those rhinos are in private hands, like they're being looked after by private individuals. So you can imagine the kind of security that one has to invest in order to keep those animals living and alive. And with no tax base, that money's got to come from somewhere, and that comes from us.
So they're the rhinos are the VIPs, eh?
The rhinos are the VIPs, and yeah, they are the VIPs, and they're cool, you know.
Yeah, celebrities.
It's an interesting experience, and it's not just the rhinos that benefit; it's the other species as well, right? So I mean, there's elephants all over the place, and you know, we're sitting around on our last evening around the campfire and eating our dinner and talking to the owners of the ranch, and you could hear the lions roaring and moaning about 100 to 200 yards off in the distance in the bush. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a pretty cool feeling. You know, we're booking it down one road going from the core of the preserve out to a cattle ranch where we did quite a bit of hunting for kudu. And we turned a corner off a bush road, like just a little trail, onto the main rural road. And we spooked a couple of wild cheetahs out of the ditch. They were down there in the long grass. We couldn't see them. And they raced off in front of our bush buggy in front of us at high speed. So, I mean, these animals are there because these people are there and because they care about them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hunters that are primarily funding that conservation effort in most of these countries, you know. The main lodge, what we called our hunting camp, which was actually a pretty nice little lodge that we stayed in, was about a 20 to a 30 minute 4x4 ride away from their main lodge. And the main lodge is where they do all their eco tours out of, because if you want to go just watch the wildlife, that's available in places like this as well. Mm-hmm. So they've got a small hotel there kind of thing, and they'll load you up in a four-wheel drive kind of bus and trot you around to look at animals all day long if that's what you want to do. But you know, during the course of the conversations that we had with the owners of the ranch and with the professional hunters, it was interesting to know that the eco-tourist aspect of it, while it's certainly good PR for them, and it brings them into the public eye, it doesn't provide the financial means that Hunting does in order to run the project. It takes approximately 9,000 ecotourists to provide the revenue that 40 hunters do on an annual basis. And now ask yourself, what kind of ecological footprint does 9,000 tourists in terms of their water consumption and their fuel consumption and all that sort of thing make?
Waste production.
Production in compared to 40 hunters.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's without hunting, there would not be rhinos in central Namibia right now.
That's their carbon footprint, I guess you could say.
You know, so, but it's interesting though, the media always plays us up to be the bad guys, right?
Yeah.
So.
You're saving the rhinos over there.
We are saving the rhinos and we're enjoying ourselves while we do it. I mean, we do it partly because we care about the wildlife and we care about their environment and we want these things to continue on into the future, right? Mm-hmm. And we partly do it because we love doing it. You know, I grew up hunting and hunting is a part of who I am. And an adventure in a place like Namibia is just something that is a part of what I wanted to be in my life. And I wouldn't change any of it for anything. So, you know, the idea that you can take something you love and something that's a part of you and turn it into something that's positive for everybody is a great idea, I think. So.
Well, we got a couple of minutes left, so let's get into the gory detail real quick.
Yeah.
How many animals did you shoot and what did you shoot?
Well, between my son and I, we took 10 animals. So that sounds like a lot because normally in the course of a year here, we might shoot one or two big game animals, like a deer and a moose might be about it. But, you know, you have to understand that you're hunting in an area that's incredibly dense with game. And you're hunting constantly every day from sunup to sundown for anywhere from 8 to 15 days. So, you know, we're hunting primarily antelope species. So my son shot a black wildebeest bull. He shot a water buck, a big water buck bull, and a little tiny antelope called a steam buck, which is one of the smallest antelope in the country. And it's actually the hardest thing to hunt, I think, while we were there. They're tiny, they're extremely fast. And because the grass is so tall everywhere, they're really hard to see. You can't see them until you're on top of them. So he spent a lot of time trying to shoot a little tiny antelope. And then he shot a couple of impala. He shot a black-faced impala, which is another great success story for Namibia. They used to be endangered. Now they thrive everywhere. They exist in huntable populations from the Angolan border south into central Namibia. So that was a great experience for us. Mm-hmm. Myself, I kind of finally killed my kudu curse. I was in South Africa in 2008 looking for kudu bull and never connected. And finally, on the last day of the hunt, last morning, I connected with my kudu bull. That was a tough hunt. And that was, I thought I was going home without one, but got lucky. Then I killed a monster blue wildebeest bull that will probably make every record book known to man. And that's springbuck that'll do the same. And then I killed a warthog with just some wicked tusks and teeth. Oh, and my gemsbuck. And the gemsbuck was just wicked. And eventually we got some great video, by the way, of gemsbuck herds running as a herd. They are something to behold. So I'll have some of that video up on my blog here in the next little while.
Which reminds me, why don't you tell everybody where to find your blog?
Our blog is www.canadiangunblog.com. And there's actually a pictorial essay up right now of the hunt. So there's lots of pictures and some descriptions up there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us. And as I said in the beginning, you know, I just found it fascinating how you know, there's people in our society that always want to make hunters out to be the bad guys. And the only reason that there's rhinos left in Africa is because of the revenue that hunters provide. And with a low carbon footprint, you know, fraction of that of an ecotourist, right?
We are environmentally friendly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, we are.
So just a really interesting story. So I appreciate you sharing it with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks, Scott.
This is another episode of the CCFR Radio Podcast. Remember, if you don't stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms, who will? Join the CCFR or donate right now at www.firearmrights.ca.